And now, Pack Hollywood Hour Top 10 with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
An interesting conversation, Dean, that we've been having before everyone could hear us about
yes.
visual
oh, we
arts.
Were recording that?
Yeah, no, we weren't. Welcome, everybody, to your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour to this.
Hi, everyone.
The sixth of 10 promised top 10 shows that we'll be delivering during this year 10 of the show that continues to change the way people listen to the internet.
Absolutely.
Today we focus on movies, as we did last week, but we were talking about the four top 10 shows that we still have yet to produce this year.
Right.
One of us, as we've talked about before, will be top 10 things that occur to us now as we watch our documentary, The Truth Is Out There, so many years later, and while we're in the midst of working on the follow-up. And another one that we've promised is top 10 all-time most overlooked science fiction films.
Yes.
That'll be really interesting, I think. And then we'll wrap up the year with each of our top 10 lists of our, what for you and me, are our most memorable episodes of Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Not best or worst. I mean, they could be either, but just for whatever reason, most memorable. But in the midst of that, will be one that I'm really looking forward to, because it's something we've never come close to doing. We've talked about painting and sculpture and so many different art forms, but we've never done a show that specifically focuses on our favorite artists in a myriad of mediums. And the discussion that we were having already was, what do we call it? Do we call it our top 10 favorite fine artists, our top 10 favorite visual artists? And you favored visual, but then I pointed out that could be filmmakers, and we want this to be outside motion pictures,
filmmaking.
Although many artists do incorporate video and film into their gallery work, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Some in terms of high def and slow motion work and all that sort of thing.
But I don't know. We define by what we eliminate. We're not talking about narrative films. We're not talking about performance artists, right?
Right.
So I said, well, could we call these fine artists? And you were making a point about how you shy away from that term because it delineates things in a way that you're not comfortable with.
Well, yeah, because if you say fine art, how do you differentiate between that found art, outsider art? You know, fine art suggests that it's gotten into a marketing machine that is gallery representation, collector status, magazines, you know, and there's plenty of people who are fantastic, who are outside of that, who only represent themselves on Instagram or on certain websites and online galleries and that sort of thing. So fine art to me has a connotation of a hierarchy that I'm somewhat uncomfortable with. Right.
Which, if I said that the reason that something is called street art is because it is being separated from the concept of fine art, would that speak to one of the ways that you mean this? Okay.
Absolutely. Because, you know, a street artist chooses to represent his canvas as just brick walls or, well, you know.
Yeah. And to me, that's still fine art, you know, but I guess what you're saying is academically it's referred to as street art as if there is a difference between it. So the difference should be meaningless. So we've got to figure out a way.
A term.
Yeah.
First we come up with a term.
Yeah. Artists is good. It's just that artists as opposed to filmmakers. I mean, we have talked about how some filmmakers are, in fact, artists. Some are geniuses. Very few are both. So non-filmmaking, non-music. See, it's so hard. It's so hard to do a term that doesn't include. So anyway, if anyone listening, anyone within the sound of my voice, the loyal legion of Chilpack Hollywood, the Chilpackers, the global Chilpack nation, and all the ships at sea, please, if you have a term, let us know. Chilpack Hollywood. Right. At yahoo.com, chillpackhollywood at yahoo.com. And indeed, we did get a very interesting email from a loyal listener about what actors look to get from directors on set. And if we could address that. However, we will talk about that on next week's show. Also, on next week's show, of course, we are going to have to cover my tour of the now defunct and crumbling Rockhaven Sanitarium. I said, of course, like I was Dean Haglund, because you will say that. Of course is a phrase you use when what is about to come out is wholly unexpected. Like, what'd you do this weekend? Well, I, of course, had the command performance for the Queen of Thailand. What? Oh, yeah. Didn't I tell you about that?
Did I tell you? As one does. I see what you're saying.
Anyway, but we also will, of course, get back to celebrity deaths.
Of course.
You know, there was a time, Dean, I recall, where we would go weeks on end without celebrating the life of a deceased celebrity. And now we can't escape it. The bodies keep piling up faster than we can give them their legacy a fair autopsy. You know what I'm saying?
Right. I do know what you're saying.
So
there's a lot to go through.
Yeah, I mean we've got at this point, and of course I'm sure the list will only grow. Great British. Comedian, character actor Gordon Kaye. We've got one of the biggest TV stars in American history, Mike Connors.
I didn't know he died.
Yeah, we've got, the great, great actor of stage and screen, John Hurt, and of course, the iconic Mary Tyler Moore.
And how about Barbara Hale? Perry Mason's secretary.
So we opened this week's show. With the early theme from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, just to let everyone know that we will be getting to these and we will be talking about them, and we look forward to talking about them, though we have other business to tend to this week. But it was interesting listening to the early show theme, because everyone remembers the, you know, you can turn the world on with a smile. Yeah, but that's a different version of the song. The early version of the song in the early seasons was very... not scary is not the right word. It's cautiously hopeful with sadness and fear mixed into it, because of course the show was about a recent divorcee who's entering the workforce for the first time. So
by yourself in a new city, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So instead of the big refrain at the end, you're going to make it after all, as people just heard, the lyrics are, you might just make it after all. And so it really touched a chord in me about how this wholesome family entertainment that was such a big hit was really speaking to some genuine fears and issues that people were facing at that point in time. And anyway, we will close with the more uplifting, optimistic Mary Tyler Moore Show theme. At the end of today's show. All that is next week. And although we may just weigh in on Oscar nominations from time to time on this week's show, we will completely take the Academy to task on next week's program. But quickly, I just wanted to ask, before we get into this, because we are talking about great movies this week, John Hurt, you got any particular favorite or particular favorite story? We'll talk about his bio and his training and all that stuff next week, but I'm just curious, any indelible cinematic memory for him or any indelible story?
Well, the cinematic memories, of course, Alien and the I, Claudius. We, back in Vancouver, we were going to do an improv takeoff on I, Claudius, if you can imagine. Completely improvised Roman Senate improv that we were working on. And we watched I, Claudius ad infinitum. And as much as Derek Jacobi was the lead of that show, it was John Hurt that we kept being drawn to time and time again. The show never came to fruition. It was abandoned. But there was one summer where every day it was John Hurt on my TV, and I loved it.
You and I worked on a film together called Spectres, a science fiction ghost story.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it is known to many viewers who caught it on Lifetime and the Lifetime networks as Soul Survivor.
Yes.
And anyway, Spectres had its world premiere in London as part of the Sci-Fi London Film Festival. And as such, it was in the big on the big screen at the Curzon Soho, just an amazing theater there in London. And it was my first ever trip to London. And I got there a bit before you did, a bit before the rest of our team, Bud Robertson. And and on the first full day, I went and checked in at the Curzon Soho, the flagship headquarters for, you know, hosting the festival, introduced myself to the festival director and some of those people. And as I descended down into the earth, into that theater, because
underground theater,
because it was such, you know, that's a cultural thing for me growing up on the West Coast. I mean, yeah, we have maybe now bars in downtown LA like the Edison or the Crocker Club that go down into the earth. But for the most part, right, everything on the West Coast is built above ground. And,
absolutely, yeah.
So there, because space is at a premium on these old buildings and everything, you go downward. And so you enter what you think is, you know, ground floor, obviously. But then you go down into the cinema. And, you know, there's bars on every level. And I don't think yeah. I had ever been to a movie theater that had a bar before.
In it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That was your first experience of that.
Now, of course, it's, again, quite commonplace here in the States, here in Los Angeles. But I'd never been to one before. And so that struck me as I went down every single level. And then, after introducing everybody, I thought, well, you know, when in London, and with 20 minutes to go before seeing my first film, I helped myself to the bar here. I think it's late morning or early afternoon or whatever. And I get a drink. And who am I sitting at the bar next to but John Hurt?
No way.
He's there to see a film. And like any good cinema enthusiast, at midday, he's having a drink.
Just to warm him into that movie watching experience.
And so anyway, I don't remember. I mean, I know we talked because I asked him what he was seeing or what have you, but I don't really remember the conversation. I just remember this is the perfect beginning to my first London trip.
Aww. I know you told me these stories before, but I didn't realize it coalesced in your very first experience and your very first day in London. Yeah. I thought you had been to London before on that trip, so I was
not
sharing your...
I had a great...
Why'd I wonder?
Well, I had an amazingly... I don't know, not inappropriate, that's not the right word, but when you're given the wrong impression, but even that sounds wrong, but my introduction to London was fascinating on so many levels, and we don't really have time for it, but I will say that, you know, I arrived in the late afternoon, took a quick nap at the hotel, and when I awoke, it was snowing.
Oh, that's right.
And
it was that weird snowstorm.
And it was so beautiful. And so I go out and I walk around London and I've got the whole city to myself. And
right, because the town shuts down when it snows.
Yeah, and this light frost. And I thought, boy, London's dead at night. You know, never mind the very next night when all the snow had melted and it's a weeknight still, and yet you're skating home in other people's sick, because every night of the week is like Oktoberfest on the streets of London. But
in Soho, let's
yeah. So anyway, delineate. That was magical. And then my first full day, right? I'm walking through, and it's now blue skies, and the air is so crisp and clean in London. And as I look at those old ancient empire rooftops, the ice and the snow is melting and dripping off of it. And so it looks like a hard torrential downpour in all those narrow streets and narrow alleys. But in fact, it's right. Blue skies melting what was on the roof. So very, very majestic, very poetic. And it culminates in drinking with the great and now late John Hurt. And speaking of late, I guess we ought to get to the purpose of this show, which is to count down.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And it will technically be a top 10 show because one of us has more than 10. And if we and if we average it out, we come in near 10, the top 10 best films of 2016.
So why don't you do two to every my one? Because I did not see 10 great films this year.
Yeah.
In fact, I maybe saw 5, and even those, I have caveats.
Okay, well, we can talk about caveats, and you can always go and, you know, I've got a recommendation for a dentist there in Sydney if you want to have your caveats looked at.
I got to get that caveat filled.
oh, my goodness. Experiences with cinema of 2016 could not be more different.
It's so true.
As you know, I try to be as representative on my list as possible. And what I mean by that is hopefully diversity. Male filmmakers, female filmmakers, casts and stories dealing with different races and experience, hopefully that. But also I want to be representative of all genres. And I try to be inclusive of as many countries as possible. And
right.
Honestly, this year was just too rich with really good films. So I don't even have a horror film or an animated film on my list.
Wow.
And I have
you.
And I have very few countries represented. So, there have been entire years where the majority of my list was foreign language films. And part of that was because of how great those films were. And part of it was how lackluster a year in American films it was.
Right.
Further illustration that really drove home to me, because I kept hearing what a great year for film it was. And I kept going, really? Is that true? Is it true? And I found notes that I made on August 12th, after seeing, right around there, after seeing Hell or High Water right before it opened. And
yeah.
I had written down, seeing it and knowing it was my early front runner for best film of the year. And I realized I already had the makings of an excellent top 10 list, which made me feel good.
Right.
There was Whit Stillman's Jane Austen adaptation, Love and Friendship, which was at that point the best reviewed film of the year. There was the horror film The Witch, which I raved about on this show. There was Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some, a comedy I raved about on this show. There was Alan Rickman's final dramatic vehicle, the drone warfare suspense drama Eye in the Sky, which I raved about on this show. And the Coen brothers, of course, period Hollywood satire, Hail Caesar, which we've talked about at great length on this
show.
Absolutely. So that's 6 films I really both admired and enjoyed. And that combination is quite powerful. All of them I would want to see again, even at that point. Maybe not the Whit Stillman, Jane Austen. Okay. and yet here I sit with only 2 of them out of those 6. on my final list today, just a little more than 4 months later, 5 months later, because the year was just too rich. So when I compiled my honorable mention this year, in years past, I've talked about films that were important in some way, maybe thematically, maybe because of who they introduced, maybe stylistically, whatever. They were truly honorable, though they weren't flawless enough to make my list. My honorable mention films are all films that to me are without flaw, yet that nevertheless could not squeeze their way onto the top 10.
Wow. You're kidding.
So should I talk about these?
Let's talk about those, because I am so embarrassed that, well, am I embarrassed?
No, well,
I
no,
am.
No,
I'm alarmed at how little I've seen this year.
Okay, maybe it should be your New Year's resolution to see all the Metacritic films before we do the film.
I think so.
Yeah.
That'd be fun, actually. Yeah. Okay.
Eye in the Sky, as I mentioned, Alan Rickman, his last live-action film role, he was never nominated for an Academy Award, and I had held out some hope that this film might remedy that, but sadly, this film was wildly overlooked at the time it was released, and despite amazing reviews, has been overlooked even by critics compiling top 10 lists. And,
wow.
And I guess I can't criticize them, because it's not on mine. The drone warfare story it focuses on is important and timely, and the way it effectively cross-cuts between four different locations and four different sets of actors and characters and maintains not only high tension but reveals the character of the people populating these locations is impressive storytelling.
Yes, I agree. I saw this one. It didn't make my list at all. Shockingly, only because it seemed this is how war is conducted now, that we're not massive amounts of guys being thrown in front of bullets at each other, but high tech stuff done from Las Vegas in distance, and you still get all the emotional shock of being in a war, but you're done in the comfort of a small room. Connected by headphones, much the way we play video games, you know?
Well, exactly. And so I guess maybe that's the thing, is people compare it to old-style war films and find it lacking, a la Hacksaw Ridge. And yet, this movie is exactly about the fact that maybe these new style war techniques with far less collateral damage are nevertheless far more dehumanizing.
Absolutely. You know, I was in Vegas a while back. This was a couple of years ago, but I met drone operators and they said, yeah, we still get the same post-traumatic stress disorders, even though we're not on the battlefield. We're just doing it in a room. But you're so in the screens and controlling the drones that you have the same emotional scarring that you would if you were walking on the front lines with a gun and people shooting at you.
My second film on my honorable mention list is Everybody Wants Some. And Richard Linklater is on such an incredible roll. This is a period era sports and college comedy. It's raunchy, it's stylish, it's fast, it's touching, and it's funny as hell. And if I was doing my favorite films of the year, it would be in my top five, but I'm not. I'm doing the best films of the year. But also it drives me nuts because this is a movie that gets largely overlooked because it's released only into art houses, because it's a Richard Linklater film, and it's an independent. And yet, if this was released in the 1980s, this is as successful as a movie like Porky's, for God's sakes. Because it's such a raunchy, crowd-pleasing, Animal House-esque movie, but really good.
Wow. And what's it called?
Everybody Wants Some! Exclamation mark.
I've never even seen this on the airplane flight.
So funny. It's so damn funny. Now, the horror film that I mentioned before, The Witch, if witches and butts were clusters of nuts, we'd all have a bowl of granola. The Witch is the best horror film I saw all year. It's set during the era of the Salem witch trials. The movie was beset by a misleading marketing campaign, which got butts into the seats, but made those people hate the movie.
Right.
The movie instead is delivering a timely allegory to the world in which we live right now in terms of the oppressive nature and judgmental nature of authority within our community and about our rejection of not only nature, but our own nature. And that if we don't get a healthy relationship going with our own natures and with nature, nature's going to get some nasty revenge, both the outward nature and our inner nature. I can't wait to watch this movie again, honestly. And finally, my last honorable mention, the best animated feature I saw all year, Kubo and the Two Strings. And this is from Laika Animation, right? The company that did Paranorman and Coraline. And it is...
stop motion.
Yeah, and it's not only impressive technically, as all their movies are, but it's also a film that manages to avoid the action film ending that, as you know, has become for me so distastefully de rigueur in animated films these days, right?
Yes.
Where everything's got to end in explosions. Every resolution comes through action and violence. This film gives us the action and then undercuts it by suggesting that compassion and nonviolence are truly the only ways to resolve, not end, but resolve any conflict.
Wow.
And by the way, as any good film that is actually overtly about storytelling ought to do.
Yeah, I want to see this now. How do you resolve a conflict without violence?
Yes.
Because that seems to be their only go-to these days.
I think you'll really love it, and I think you'll actually, to a degree, see yourself in the main character a bit, the boy.
Wow.
Kubo, yeah.
You're talking like it's a David Lynch film.
No, it is not. It is not. If you'd just shown it to me, I might thought, wow, the technique is different, but does this come from Studio Ghibli, the Miyazaki studio in Japan? And it doesn't.
Oh.
It's American filmmakers, an American story, though set in Japan. Kubo and the Two Strings. So that brings me to my top 10. Do I get started or do you want to...
Yeah, you get started because I technically have 5 films that I like this year.
All right. At number 10, I'm cheating. A two-way tie. There you go. I said it. though there have been years where you have had a full 10 and you've had a two-way tie for first. So you kept 2 through 10 and then ended up having 11 because of the top of your list. And I asked you, well, why wouldn't you just drop everyone down? What? Anyway.
That's true.
My two-way tie for 10th. And you'll see what I'm doing here. They are linked. The first is OJ Made in America. And it is a 467-minute long documentary directed by Ezra Edelman. The truck in the background behind you, Dean, sounds so big that it must be unloading a 467-minute long documentary.
It's garbage day here in Newtown, Australia.
Which is odd because last week was garbage day on Chillback Hollywood Hour when we counted down the 10 worst films of the year.
See?
Director Ezra Edelman uses interviews, new footage, archival audio and video to trace the life and career of O.J. Simpson, as the title would indicate, starting with his arrival at the University of Southern California as an emerging football superstar and ending with his incarceration in 2007 for armed robbery. This life it examines is merely the opportunity to zoom in on a specific character while getting to know a wide panoply of people and events that reveal a comprehensive portrait of race, celebrity, and sports in America over the last 50 years.
Oh, and is that what that is? I thought it was basically a documentary of the retelling of the serialized John Travolta mini episode movie.
Yeah, very little of it. I mean, a lot of it in the sense of there's more than a feature length in there of that, but it's probably less than half of it. Academy Award nominated for Best Documentary. It's tied for number 10 along with another Best Documentary nominee, I Am Not Your Negro.
Right.
This yeah.
Sounds fascinating because I know it showed up on a lot of lists, but I have not seen it here in Australia at all.
First of all, the director himself is fascinating, a 64-year-old filmmaker just hitting his stride. And the moment you see the opening credits, you realize you're in the hands of someone who is accomplished and really breaking new ground. Director Raoul Peck, by the way, apropos of, I don't know, I guess nothing, but was once Haiti's Minister of Culture. but he really does bring an international perspective to America's ongoing troubled race relations. And as you know, sometimes the outsider is the one that's capable of connecting dots for those of us on the inside, right? That's
right.
Often the role of the storyteller. He uses the notes from James Baldwin's unfinished manuscript, Remember This House, has it narrated by actor Samuel L. Jackson in one of Jackson's best performances ever. No one you would think is more recognizable than Samuel L. Jackson. And yet you never know it's his voice. And at
really?
The same time, he's not in any way doing a James Baldwin impersonation. There is so much footage of Baldwin, and you say, well, this doesn't sound like it, but damn, if you don't believe that this is how James Baldwin's inner voice, the voice of his writer, sounds. And anyway, it uses this manuscript and the recitation of this unfinished manuscript to explore the history of racism in the United States through Baldwin's reminiscences of civil rights leaders Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King Jr. It is a no-talking-head interview, there are talking heads in interviews, but it's not what we would call a talking head interview style documentary, because those interviews are historic interview footage, much of which is of the late Mr. Baldwin on historic television shows. Rather, this creates more of a biopic quality, while at the same time being something akin to what I am learning to call a film essay, which to me is a thrilling subgenre of documentary. Think of like Orson Welles' F for Fake and last year Laurie Anderson's Life of a Dog, which I really loved, and the forthcoming part two of The Truth is Out There. These film essays allow for truly and incredibly cinematic presentations. And indeed, aside from how important and moving I Am Not Your Negro is, it's thrilling cinema. Again, Raoul Peck, 64 years of age, he is the real cinematic deal.
Wow. That sounds fascinating.
It's so much fun. I mean, it's heartbreaking and heart-wrenching and angry, you know, and provocative. And I mean, I love the fact that on IMDb, it gets a user rating of 4 out of 10. because it is pushing some buttons, but it is, incredibly effective in doing so. So those are my
awesome.
Number tens. You want to hit
those
us with
are my
one?
Number tens. Well, yeah, let me throw in my number five, because
there's
only five films.
Okay. There we go. All right.
But it's a documentary as well. And
okay.
This one was fascinating to me because it resonated kind of deeply with me, oddly enough, in that I'm talking about Wiener, the documentary on Anthony Weiner's run for mayor in New York, and he allowed this film crew to follow him around. And what's shocking to me is his blind spot for his own failings that are clearly evident. The filmmakers see it. Everybody sees it. Except maybe his wife, but everybody sees these character flaws but himself. And it took me aback because then I go, well, wait a sec. What character flaws do I not see in myself that I would need a film crew to follow me around to exacerbate and highlight them? And you know, maybe there's something larger. Like this film, that made me go, oh, I feel sorry for Anthony
Well,
Reader.
I think we better be getting the answer to that when we count down the 10 things that occur to us now watching The Truth Is Out There.
Exactly. Because I don't know if that one, I mean, does it get to the essence of, does it get to my blind spots?
Well,
I don't know. I don't think
when you watch it, you'll find out now that this is framed for you in this way.
Now that's framed in the Anthony Weiner documentary?
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
be interesting.
That could very well be. It's very interesting, and I really thought it was a fascinating character sketch flawed human.
I love it, which is to say human. I mean, some are more flawed than others. But the blind spot is the thing, the size of the blind spot, right? Because I don't think anybody's more flawed than anybody else, but the size of the blind spot varies from person to person. And so he steps fully into this life where the very things that made him an effective communicator and political figure are also the very things that prevent him from being that.
I know, right? So
his
your strength is your weakness.
But for him, it's often at the exact same time.
That's the shocking thing. And then you go, okay, so what do I think is my strength, and is it kneecapping me unbeknownst to myself, you know? So again and again, you go, how does he not see this? How does he not embrace his flaws? And, well, and then it just, well, actually, it scared the shit out of me, really, ultimately.
All right. So, Wiener is one of your five films. I like it. Okay. Number nine for me comes from your part of the world. It's The Hunt for the Wilder People. And this is written and directed by Taika Waititi, whose previous film, What We Do in the Shadows, we both loved. It stars Sam Neill and Julian Dennison with hilarious supporting turns from so many terrific New Zealand performers, including Rhys Darby, Rachel House, and Taika Waititi himself. The film's an adventure comedy drama adaptation of the book Wild Pork and Watercress by Barry Crump. And in it, Sam Neill and Julian Dennison play Uncle Hector and Ricky Baker, a father figure and a son who become the targets of a manhunt after fleeing into the New Zealand bush. In a year when all the best films deal with either grief and isolation or class and race relations or both, this film deals with all of them and at the same time uses hilarious comedy to make people look at the mass incarceration of Indigenous people in New Zealand, and while doing so reminds us of how prevalent that very mass incarceration policy is in many parts of the world, like the USA, first with Natives, and then over the last 150 years with Blacks. YTT has now moved on to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but I hope he won't leave New Zealand fully behind. I know the budgets down there make it tough for him to be able to explore the kind of stories and the kind of canvas he probably wants. But I got to tell you, no one around the world is making movies like him, even if at times his films seem like a little bit of an odd hybrid between Napoleon Dynamite and Wes Anderson. He is nevertheless, when it comes to style and theme, truly unique. But his mastery of tone is jaw-droppingly masterful.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, now I got to see this.
I'm surprised
it's from New Zealand.
I'm surprised you didn't. You loved What We Do in the Shadows.
Yes.
This was a huge hit there in Australia. And
I know.
And it's possibly the funniest film of the year, so I don't understand...
What's my problem?
Where was Dean Haglund with this?
He was busy. There's a lot going on every evening.
All right. Watching movies like London Is Falling. Okay.
That's on the plane. I'm stuck on a plane.
Number eight. Well, thank God for that, or you wouldn't have had 90 worst films of the year. number eight for me, Nocturnal Animals. No 2016 release surprised me more. than this neo-noir psychological thriller written and directed by Tom Ford and starring Amy Adams. It surprised me because, of course, Tom Ford is a fashion designer whose directorial debut was a movie called A Single Man, which was nice to look at, but was a glass house filled with paper dolls instead of characters, through no fault of the work Colin Firth was doing in that film. And and Amy Adams, for her part, of course, has become, as I have said before, a fraud as a performer. And sure enough, this film literally begins as a portrait of a fraud living in a glass house. And it's full of terrible performances and artificiality.
What?
This time around, though, Ford is able to thread the needle of his ambition to show that these things are not the flaw in his filmmaking. They are the point. The Amy Adams,
fascinating.
The Amy Adams character receives a soon-to-be-published manuscript from her ex-husband, which she begins to read, and as she does, we see that film come to life within her mind, one that is gritty and realistic, if not actually real. There is depth here, exploring how we live through our imaginations, how through our empathic interaction with unmediated stories, we come much closer to living the lives and being the people we want to be. Ah, it's brilliant. And it
That's brilliant.
And it features terrific supporting work in that story within the story from Jake Gyllenhaal, from Aaron Taylor Johnson, and from the at long last, finally Academy Award nominated once again, Michael Shannon.
So does this make you go back and look at his first film with that eye that he was the artificiality being the point?
Yes.
Would that make his
absolutely
first film?
Absolutely, and it's no stretch when you think about the life that that man is hiding and not able to express and live. The problem was one of keeping us behind glass and really not being able to share in what it felt like for that man. But I do want to watch it again now with that in mind. Because, you know, when things go wrong, I learn a lot from asking, okay, what choice maybe made this thing go astray.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Armchair directing, I call it.
Well, no, I call it going back to school. That's how I learn.
See?
If you can't learn, if you can't learn from other people's missteps and you're only going to be learning from your own, ooh, you're going to be making even more to learn from than you would have before.
Exactly.
Right?
That's a long road to hoe.
So that's my number eight. Why don't you hit us with another one, Dean Haglund? This would be your number four.
Okay, so this is going to be controversial in that I know you hated the trailer of this and you thought so many ill, but I enjoyed Star Trek Beyond. That's where I'm staking a claim. I thought it had, albeit, yes, a lot of it's stuck on a planet and the Enterprise is smashed to bits, spoiler alert. But the bad guy is my favorite, Mr. Elba, Idris Elba, as the evildoer in this one. I thought it held together. I thought it felt very much like a Star Trek film. And it sits there at my number four of my favorite films of the year. That's it, eh? Dead silence?
I think the internet must have given out because I would like to point out, you know, I see every film on the Metacritic consensus of the top 30 films of the year, but I'm going deep cuts this year. I'm already to 40 of the top 50. But
yeah.
I would like to point out that you are not alone in this world. Two other people had this on their top 10 list. So congratulations.
Okay.
The three of you will enjoy many viewings of this film together. I love though that Star Trek Beyond. Well, I like, so here's the alternate Star Trek universe films. No, for us, we both, I think, had J.J. Abrams' first Star Trek on our top 10 list. Maybe.
Maybe.
We both had the second one on our worst list. And now
yes,
you're right back
sure.
to having it on your best list. So I think that's interesting.
So, well, that's interesting.
So they should
not
bother to make a fourth one, or else we know where you're
exactly
coming in on it.
It'll also
and I'm
impact,
at the point of just like, who cares on any of these? There you are.
I don't know. Star Trek still has, it still resonates.
Does it? Does it though? I mean, not when you think about how many hundreds of millions of dollars that thing lost. So we'll see.
Yeah. Okay. So box office aside, it's, you know.
But that means it didn't resonate. That means it didn't resonate with the fans that J.J. Abrams brought into it for the first one, and it didn't resonate with people who like Star Trek either. So
okay,
I'll just point that out.
But does J.J. Abrams have a fan base, or are they?
Well, he's
just,
not doing these anymore anyway. So
right, exactly. A and B. Do you actually run out to see a J.J. Abrams film? No.
No,
you
of
go
not.
To go. Oh,
no,
thank
I mean,
God that
I,
guy
I,
has taken over something.
I decide. No, I decide that we should probably burn every cinema to the ground to prevent anyone from having to. I mean,
in your time,
if I had to come, if I had to come anywhere near a theater showing Force Awakens again, I would take my own life. Okay, number seven, Manchester by the Sea. That's my number seven. Written and directed by Kenneth Lonergan, this story of grief, isolation, family, and forgiveness is proof to me that we do, in fact, need more playwrights writing original screenplays. Playwrights have developed an actual voice, and in a way that, you know, screenwriters are often not allowed to. Right?
Right. Exactly.
But playwrights have already developed that voice. And this is not a new phenomenon. This is why in the golden age of Hollywood, the studios would reach out to bring in successful novelists and playwrights, because they knew that that's the one thing they couldn't teach in the studio system, which is how to have an actual voice.
Right, how to develop.
And then the other thing about it is many, many great playwrights actually understand the capabilities of actors in a way virtually no film school graduates seem to.
That's true, because they're not actively working.
Yeah.
Playwrights are there in rehearsal, rewriting as they see the actors perform. That's never the process in filmmaking.
And they can see what they're capable of doing. The film stars Casey Affleck, Michelle Williams, Kyle Chandler, Gretchen Mol, and Lucas Hedges. The plot follows a man who looks after his teenage nephew after the boy's father dies. That man himself is responsible for the accidental death of his own children and the subsequent collapse of his marriage. So this is a painful film, and especially so because it's so truthful in the science, in the silences, in what the people aren't saying. And by the way, that's another thing that playwrights understand in a way screenwriters don't, that scenes are always about what's not being said, just like in life. It's nominated
just
for
like in life.
Best Picture. My number six, and then we'll get to another one of yours. My number six, nominated for Best Foreign Language Film, winner of 5 European Film Awards, including Best Picture, and really one of the great, in a year that was really good around the world for comedy, this is one of the great comedies. Written and directed by Marinad Ade, I think is how it's pronounced, from Germany, Tony Erdmann. And Tony Erdmann focuses on a character named Winfried Conradi. He's a divorced music teacher and an old hippie of sorts with a passion for bizarre pranks that involve adopting often fake personas. While he is grieving the death of his dog, he decides to reconnect with his daughter Inez, who is pursuing a career in business consulting in Bucharest, Romania, where she works on a project that will outsource that country's oil industry. And what ensues based on that premise is the funniest and not coincidentally one of the most touching films of the year, based entirely on the principle of slow build. This movie is almost 3 hours long, a comedy almost 3 hours long. But it allows, like I said, these slow builds of scenes that totally, time and again, catch you off guard. The performance by the daughter, the actress Sandra Hüller, is incredibly brave, with full vulnerability revealed layer by layer, a true peeling away of the onion to get to a point of just heartbreaking revelation. And the actor who plays both Mr. Conradi and the titular Tony Erdmann, I can only assume is a big deal in the German-speaking world, even though I don't know if I've seen him in anything before, because Peter Simonischek's performance is a genuine masterclass in comedic acting.
Wow. Now I have to see this. Did that get wide release?
I think so, because it's winner of like every best foreign language film around the world. And like I said, it swept the European Film Awards.
Oh, look at me not being part of Europe.
Why don't you hit me with another one?
Okay, look at this. You know, this as well, some people hate it, but I kind of really enjoyed it. Maybe because I was missing Los Angeles so much, particularly the 1970s Los Angeles. This is Shane Black's written and directed The Nice Guys with Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe.
This did make a lot of top 10 lists, and yet at the same time felt tragically overlooked. It was overlooked by audiences. It did fine, but it wasn't a hit. And I maintain that's because people can't follow mysteries anymore. And
that's it. It's a complex plot too, right? I mean, it's a lot of threads to put in. And so you have to concentrate and, you know, you have to have enjoyed the 1970s in Los Angeles a little bit. Not that I ever did, but there's, you know,
or
a lot of throwbacks.
Or enjoy not enjoying it.
Yes, exactly.
Right? There's that element of it, too. If you really enjoy the cringeworthy nature of it, then you can enjoy the film as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And to realize there's still so much of the 1970s still existing. I mean, so many of the locations that Shane used still exist. Like, you can go to those bars. You can see Kohl's. He shot at Kohl's in downtown L.A. in that secret bar beside it, not the one in the back, but the other one. I forget the name of that one. But that is a very 1970 bar, and that looked like the location for a number of scenes in this movie. So if you miss L.A., if you miss downtown L.A. and hanging out in 70s bars like I did, then you'll love The Nice Guys.
It is very funny. It's Ryan Gosling's nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actor for La La Land. I would have no problem with him being nominated for The Nice Guys.
Yeah.
And really, everything he's doing that's good in La La Land is just feels like warm-up takes, rehearsals for The Nice Guys.
It's true, right? Because there's I haven't seen La La Land yet,
but
it's on my list.
He is a comedic actor. He's really gifted. He's really gifted, and you really get to see those gifts on full display in The Nice Guys. And he gets to physically move in a way that's actually far more impressive than his dancing in La La Land.
Isn't that true? A lot of his drunken work at the party where he falls over the side and stuff like that, I thought was loose, yet very well timed and coordinated. It's so hard. So often you see actors playing drunk by just letting go and not being specific, whereas he was being very specific because he had to, because there was major pratfalls and stuff going on.
Physical comedy is a kind of action that is really akin to dancing, in that the performer can't rely on a double, on a stunt performer, to make it look good. Because if we lose for a minute that immediate identification with the character, i.e. mm-hmm. if we can't see that it is them, then it no longer is funny. We're then watching it. We're not involved with it.
Absolutely. And this is why we are so far away from, well, are we far away from physical comedy in our
maybe
in our culture at the moment?
It's
a lot of spoken word stuff at the time.
Yeah, or it's action.
You're right.
You know, we have comedy and we combine it with action, but we don't do a lot of the physical comedy anymore. That is absolutely true. And because a lot of the training's not there, right?
Right. Where do you get that kind of stage time to develop that?
As we've talked about from the behind the camera point of view, if there's a belief that comedies don't make money, then you're not being encouraged to find your comedic voice behind the camera. And if comedies don't make money, just like talking about La La Land, right? I mean, I'm not a fan. No movie makes me more angry, but I gave it a positive review when it came out because I wanted it to be successful enough so that we can keep getting more musicals, because as we get more, then people will get better at them.
Right.
And this is true with physical comedy. Okay, number four for me. Number five. I don't want to skip number five. Of course not. Speaking of La La Land and old Hollywood and older forms and everything. Number five, written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, starring Josh Brolin and George Clooney, with hilarious support from Channing Tatum, Ralph Fiennes, Scarlett Johansson, Tilda Swinton, Frances McDormand, Clancy Brown, and a star-making turn by future Han Solo, Alden Ehrenreich. This ought to be the picture everyone is championing instead of La La Land. But some people don't like period pictures or old Hollywood, yet they'll fall all over themselves loving paper-thin, barely competent rip-offs of old Hollywood because they don't know their history. By the way, Dean, I neglected to mention this. I should point out that today's show is brought to you by La La Land, the recipient of 14 Academy Award nominations and the height of mediocrity. La La Land is now playing at a theater near you. Consult local listings. And now, on with the countdown. As I was saying, Hail Caesar uses the best of old filmmaking techniques to not only make a Hollywood satire set in the Golden Age, but one that could have been made in the Golden Age. It's so fast and so smart that it often seems not to be about anything, which underscores the idea it's exploring of how many subversive messages are contained in movies of that era. Oh,
absolutely,
and
right?
By the way, the musical numbers, so vastly superior to those in La La Land, it's embarrassing.
I know. Just him as a sailor doing that.
No dames.
Holy smokes. And subversive and hilarious and unbelievably, just that, if you just showed that as a 5-minute short before any movie, it would obliterate any movie that comes before it. It's unbelievable how great that movie is.
Okay, that brings me to my number four, written by Eric Hesserer, who featured on last week's Worst 10 list, because he wrote Lights Out, which was one of my worst 10, and that was based on a short film. And this, one of my 10 best, is based on Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang, a Nebula Award-winning short story. Arrival is also directed by the almost peerless Denis Villeneuve, who did one of my top films of last year, Sicario, who's directing the forthcoming Blade Runner 2049. And if you have not seen the trailer, stop everything and go look at the Blade Runner 2049 trailer.
Doesn't it look great?
Oh, my God.
I'm dying to see this thing.
Arrival is a science fiction feature that belongs on a short list with Children of Men and 2001 A Space Odyssey. It's Academy Award nominated for Best Picture, and it stars Amy Adams. Yes. Two Amy Adams films on Phil's top 10 list.
Is that possible?
The old adage, only Nixon could go to China, and apparently only Larenas can go to Amy Adams movies. and yet, right, after years of being inappropriately nominated for Oscars, she goes without a nomination for either of these two impressive performances. Anyway, the story is narrated by her character, Dr. Louise Banks, writing in the past tense. After a race of aliens known as heptapods due to their 7-pointed, radially symmetrical appearance, initiate first contact with humanity. the military hires her to discover their language and communicate with them.
Right.
The story revolves around her and a physicist working for the military to gain knowledge of physics from the aliens. It's a film that argues that our next step in evolution, indeed our very survival, might be dependent upon developing a spherical consciousness, one that perceives time through that spherical consciousness and embodies constant knowledge of grief and isolation that comes from being truly connected to the nature of all things at all times. It's absolutely brilliant and so heartfelt, while at the same time, a profoundly intelligent film.
Well, this is fantastic. And I like this concept of a spherical consciousness, because when we look back at Truth Is Out There, how did we edit that thing? But spherically.
Yeah, to embody what so many people within it were describing. That was not an idea we had from the outset, but we realized the only way to grasp this information and to present it is by having a film that embodies the very thing that the people within it are arguing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How awesome is that?
So what's next for you?
Well, I have a love for, you know, comic books. And Vancouver, and there's one movie that brings it all together, and that's Deadpool. I love Deadpool. I watched this. I think this is why I don't have enough films, because one flight, I just keep rewatching it on the flight back from L.A. to Sydney. And maybe because I was falling asleep in parts of it, but I had seen now this movie 3 times in total and think it's fantastic. And to realize this was 13 years in the making, right? To get the rights to it, to champion it. How long did he hold on to it and fought to get this thing onto the screen? It was totally worth the effort. Deadpool is my what is that? Number 2 film.
Yeah. I'm surprised, honestly, that, I mean, it's gotten some top 10 love. It's the screenplay has been award nominated. But I am surprised that it hasn't ended up higher, you know, because there were years, let's face it, where like an Avengers movie or something like that has made a lot of top 10 lists. And partly it's because it was such a rich year. But also, I don't know, maybe because the tone is in a way
so dark.
But it's not just dark. Is it
morbid?
Is it safe to say that? Oh my God, we're way over time, and here I am struggling for
a word
vocabulary. Yes. So nihilistic.
Nihilistic. Yes. Absolutely. It has all of that.
Nihilism is not something that even, I mean, critics may say they like, but it makes them uncomfortable.
Absolutely, and it's yeah. And if it's not the feel-good film of the year, then you're going, well, you shouldn't champion it.
Yeah. Number 3 for me, a film that's been championed by many, so much so that I almost wanted to put it lower and champion movies that more needed it. But that would be Dirty Pool. Academy Award nominated for Best Picture. Moonlight is a 2016 American drama written and directed by Barry Jenkins, based on the play... In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. And actually, I'm wrong. It's not written and directed. It's directed brilliantly by Barry Jenkins. But it's written, again, by the playwright, Terrell Alvin McRaney.
Right.
And again, it is, you know, you think of plays, you see Fences. Fences is a strong movie, but it has a hard time sometimes breaking away from being a play. This is one of the most cinematic character pieces you could ever imagine. Starring Trevante Rhodes, Andre Holland, Janelle Monáe, Ashton Sanders, Gerald Jerome, Naomi Harris, and Mahershala Ali in an Oscar-nominated role. It's another film focusing on grief, isolation, race, class, and sexual identity relations this film, like Arrival, also encourages us to develop a new sense of time through a new consciousness. The film has three different actors at different ages playing the main character of Little, who becomes Chiron, who becomes Black. It's a film for anyone who seeks connection, anyone who seeks redemption, and anyone who seeks a sense of living according to their authentic identity. This film is nothing less than poetry.
Wow. I'm seeing great things about this, and yet I can't, no one can actually describe the plot to me. So it's hard to go, hey, let's go see this movie called Moonlight. It's about what now? Well, now that you explained it, I have to go see it.
And I'll do my number two, and then we'll get to, I think, your number one, right?
Yes.
So my number two, I mentioned it before, Academy Award nominated for Best Picture. It's an American heist film directed by David McKenzie and written by Taylor Sheridan, whose script for this was on the 2012 blacklist of best screenplays never to have been produced. It's called Hell or High Water. And the film follows two brothers who carry out a series of bank robberies to save their family ranch. The brothers are played by Chris Pine and Ben Foster. And it focuses on the nearing retirement Texas Ranger who's tracking them down, trying to stop them, played by Jeff Bridges. The caper is intricate, it makes emotional sense, and has us rooting for the bad guy brothers. The professionalism of the Texas Rangers following them and their uneasy friendship, one played by Bridges is a cowboy, the other is an Indian, Native American, makes us want them to succeed in catching them. So we're rooting right. for both sets. So we the audience, have conflicting impulses and we have conflicting rooting interests, and then violence erupts, which complicates everything, rendering intentions and aims secondary. In short, there might be no film this year to more viscerally express the untenable conflicts people throughout this country are expected to carry as burdens simply in the name of having a job and keeping a roof over their heads. And there has been no film of this genre as good since the high point of American cinema in the 1970s. Oh yeah, and by the way, it's hilarious! And every single character has a reason for being in it, and every performer, no matter how inexperienced nor how brief their screen time, each performer makes an indelible impression. Hell or High Water, a movie I wish I had made, is number two.
Wow, that is good. That sounds like fantastic movie making right there.
So we're a good 7 minutes overtime at this point, okay. But only two films left. Easy.
Right. My number one is Hail Caesar, which we talked about. And one thing we forgot to mention, locations. The fact that they found what I love so much about L.A. is that a lot of the 1930s and 20s still exists, no matter how much we try to tear it down. And no matter how I'm going to vote for Proposition M for a 2-year moratorium on development, I think Hail Caesar totally frames Los Angeles in such a beautiful way.
Well, and I talked about how they use old film techniques. So to create these sets, to create these locations, to make it look the way that it did, they wore as a badge of honor the idea that no scene would be done at only one location. So whenever, right. for example, there's two people, it's like this podcast, one person's in LA, the other's in Australia. When you see a 2-person scene often, or a 3-person scene, each person in that scene is in an entirely different location. And they combine them seamlessly. And for anyone who's made movies, this is really delightful, especially independent films, because that's an old Hollywood technique that we still sometimes have to use to this day. In my movie, The Party Crashers, there is a character where one of the terrorists holding the party hostage is having a conversation with some of the people he's holding hostage, and the terrorist is actually, I think, 12 miles away from the people he's holding hostage, even though he's supposedly in the same room with them. I love
Hilarious.
That.
Love it.
My number one is written and directed by Jim Jarmusch.
Oh.
And we don't talk about Jarmusch enough on this show. He is a genuine cinematic and, dare I say, national treasure who has
Absolutely.
Never been appreciated enough in this country. He's never earned a single Academy Award nomination throughout
right.
his whole career. And yet his new movie, Patterson, ranks right up there with his absolute best. Indeed, it is a masterpiece. It's the best
wow.
production design and cinematography of the year, completely giving us a sense of being trapped inside the main character's emotional unavailability. It gives us a full sense of experience, that character's artistic inspiration, of understanding how his poetry allows him to engage in the world, while at the same time, it allows the film to operate on another entirely symbolic level, as all true art must. The film's story is about Patterson, played by Adam Driver, who is extraordinary in this film. He's a military veteran who is a hardworking bus driver in Patterson, New Jersey. And we
right.
follow him through 7 days of his life. Weekdays offering the same routine every day. He observes the city, listens to fragments of conversations while picking up and dropping off his bus passengers. He writes heartfelt poems in a notebook. He walks his dog and drinks one beer in a local tavern after his shift is over. Waiting for him at home every day through it all is his wife, Laura, his beloved, who champions his gift of writing and who is herself a completely committed hobbyist, constantly speaking of the new ways she has realized each day that she will become fabulously successful.
Yeah.
Joseph Campbell said that the best things in life can't be discussed, for they transcend language. And he said the next best things can only be misspoken about or talked around. And so we use labels for them without ever being able to truly define by what we mean by those labels.
Right.
Love and God spring to mind as examples
right.
of these labels. And what that leaves us with, therefore, according to Campbell, is conversation. And it's important, therefore, for each of us to make conversation as nourishing as we possibly can. Hopefully we do that on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour from time to time, at least.
Once in a while.
But in order for conversation to be fully nourishing, it's important for us to be able to access our feelings and our vulnerabilities. And that's really, really hard for many people, people of good character, people of good heart and good intention. And so for that reason and for the reason that the best things cannot be spoken of, we need art because art transcends language. And Patterson, the character who is trapped by not even being able to converse about his feelings, so profound and dangerous are those feelings, he gravitates towards art and creativity. Patterson, the movie named for him, touched me deeply in the parts of my being where I know that nothing we do matters, but everything we do has great meaning, or vice versa, depending on what
wow.
point of view.
Yeah, yeah. I'm, of course, struggling that every day, right? Why do we do this? It's the and then to hear that there's a reason and that it resonates. And that there's a 2-hour experience that would explain that to me. I think it's I think I need to see this movie now.
That brings us to an end of another epic installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood
Hour.
Look, we know these top 10 film shows are always going to be long, and we didn't think they were going to be, which is why we bullshitted for so long at the top of the show. But hopefully it was nourishing conversational bullshit, the kind of fertilizer you can use to to sprout up seedlings of your own nourishing conversations. Until next week, I'm Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Haglund. We'll see you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas.
Who can turn the world on with her smile? Who can take a nothing day and suddenly make it all seem worthwhile? Well, it's you, girl, and you should know it. With each glance and every little movement you show it, love is all around.
belated spoiler alert.